Hello again, and welcome back to the Alopecia Areata Awareness Podcast series on MedAuthority. I am Dr. Britt Kreglow, and I am joined again by Dr. Layla Asborn. And I think this is probably the episode that we are maybe the most excited about because this is something, that we get to do in practice, and there are I think there's a lot of nuance to treating hair, compared to a lot of diseases that we see, and lots of questions about timing and, what to expect and who responds and who doesn't, all these things. So today we're going to talk about treatment with JAK inhibitors. So this, again, to review, is a class of medicines that targets JAK proteins, which are sort of largely responsible for modulating cytokine signaling in alopecia areata. So these, I would say for sure, are the best treatment that we have right now for this disease, really sort of pathogenesis directed. Not everybody responds to these medications, but, in general, they tend to be quite effective and they can be really, really life-changing for patients. So there are several JAK inhibitors out there. There are now, at least in the United States, we now have two approved for the treatment of alopecia areata. So one is baricitinib and the other is ritlecitinib. But prior to these approvals, we have been using JAK inhibitors off-label for AA for many years now. I think Layla, you also share my enthusiasm with like what it's like to see these patients come back in clinic and how they not only look so different, but feel really different. So maybe just kind of walk us through your conversation with a patient, or what are the kind of things you think about? Just get us started and we'll kind of go from there.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm absolutely ecstatic about the FDA approvals because it helps us in Europe as well to get access to these treatments. And it's quite a landmark moment for hair disorders. To be able to have a systemic treatment for our alopecia areata patients is incredible after years of not having much treatment and not having much success with the available treatments. So with JAK inhibitors, I think one important thing to be clear to the patients when they first start is that these are not cures. I think it's been in the media, in the mainstream media, as miracle cures. And often patients come with a very heightened expectation of these treatments. So I think addressing that and explaining how the treatment works and the fact that this is not a cure, but it's just a systemic treatment for a chronic condition like we have for psoriasis and eczema, for example. And so I would always start with addressing their expectation and seeing what they understand in terms of JAK inhibitors. But also the fact that a lot come in asking about topical ones, can I just use it on my scalp? Will that be enough? But unfortunately, topical JAK inhibitors did not work in clinical trials or in clinics. So they're not very effective. Definitely not for the scalp because they don't penetrate as well. And then I move on to talk about oral JAK inhibitors, which, there are certain risk factors that you have to take in consideration when assessing the patient. And obviously with a black box warning that's been put out there regarding tofacitinib and extended on to baricitinib and upadacitinib, we have to just explain through that. So I talk them through to see what their background history is in terms of cardiovascular risks, blood clots, malignancies, serious infections, to see if they have any previous history of that. And then that helps me then to go on to explain the black box warning and what that means in their context. I don't know, is that the approach you also take, Britt?
Yeah, I think, it's tough. And I think we do, you can't dismiss the box warning, right? So essentially all of the JAK inhibitors approved for inflammatory skin disease, at least here in the United States, have this box warning about, as you mentioned, increased risk for malignancy, serious infection, major adverse cardiovascular events, thrombosis. Importantly, a lot of that came from a study, as you mentioned, of tofacitinib in a population of patients with rheumatoid arthritis who were over 50, had at least one cardiovascular risk factor, most of whom were also taking methotrexate. So we're not really comparing apples to apples, but importantly, these things have been seen across trials with JAK inhibitors. And I think you're right in that it's really about the patient in front of you, right? If the patient, most of our patients, fortunately, with alopecia areata are pretty young and healthy. And so their baseline risk for these things is probably really quite low. So does this medicine increase it a tiny bit more? Maybe. But if you have somebody who is, you know, 65 and obese and a smoker, the conversation probably looks a little bit different, right? Because that person already has an elevated baseline risk. But I do think, you know, it's important to talk about safety. But I find, you know, I think I imagine as you do also that most patients with severe alopecia areata they're so impacted by this disease that they're willing to accept some level of risk for a chance at normalcy. I mean, basically people want to be back to normal.
Oh, absolutely. And interestingly, because we've been using it for a few years before the approvals and, you know, we were using it unlicensed. And before the black box warning, we came to a situation where there were people who had been on tofacitinib or baricitinib for a couple of years. And then, you know, you went back to revisit some of the risk factors and discuss the black box warning. And you realized actually those were people who would be deemed high risk. You know, I had a man in his 50s. With history of blood clot, I mean, family history of blood clots and a positive factor V Leiden, who was adamant that he would not stop the treatment because he had regrown his hair, and going back to a life without hair was just not acceptable to him. He would rather take his own life than, you know, go back to that. So he carried on the treatment knowingly that he's very high risk. And absolutely, you have to be honest with these patients, but you also have to appreciate their, you know, the impact their disease is having on them. And, you know, just have a discussion and informed consent of being on this treatment and how the monitoring would work. I don't really change my monitoring. I just re-stratify them every time in terms of the risk factors to kind of counsel them at every opportunity. So I wouldn't change my blood test monitoring, but I would suggest addressing their cardiovascular risk. So if someone's a smoker, I would tell them to stop smoking. You know, if they have high blood pressure, then I tell them they need to sort it out and address it, or, you know, lose weight or exercise, you know, all the cardiovascular parameters that you can address and the patient can address themselves.
Yeah, for sure. If there are modifiable risk factors, this is very motivating for patients, right? If we say, you know, okay, we can do this, but you need to stop smoking or, you know, XYZ. I find that, you know, many of them are willing to do that. So, you know, in terms of that conversation, a discussion about risk, obviously very important, number one. And then I think expectations for response are really important. So it's interesting. I would say, you know, if you look at the clinical trials in alopecia areata, one thing that's very important is that endpoints are late, right? So we're used to atopic dermatitis or psoriasis when we're seeing endpoints at 12, maybe 16 weeks. The primary endpoints are assessed at either 6 months or 9 months in clinical trials for alopecia areata. So as we mentioned sort of briefly before, hair growth takes time. And I think that's something that, you know, we need to establish from the outset. But I don't know about you, but patients they're willing to wait. You know, it's very different from, you know, certain other, I think in psoriasis, I feel like people wanted to be better yesterday. I mean, obviously patients with alopecia areata wanted to be better yesterday also, but you know, they're in this for the long haul. So if you tell them, you know, it's going to be 4 to 6 months before we kind of have an idea of where you're going. Well, you know, that's okay. But they need to know that from the outset, right? Because otherwise you're going to be getting, you know, a call or a message at 3 or 4 weeks and nothing's happened, you know, nothing's happening. I don't know what to do. Yeah, and it's like, that's normal, right?
Yeah. I always tell them, like, I'm seeing you back in 3 months only to see how you're doing. I am not expecting any hair. And often I just do it as a telephone consultation to reduce that sort of anxiety that they've not grown any hair. But you're right. Yeah. You need to inform them, because otherwise they're sort of very anxious already because of the fact that they've, you know, had to go through having alopecia areata and then not really having much success with treatments. So they're very anxious to start off with. So addressing the expectation is key.
Yeah, so this is definitely a marathon and not a sprint. And then I think also importantly for people with severe disease, this is a chronic therapy. As you mentioned, it is not a cure. It is a treatment. You know, everybody, including doctors, when we give talks, ask, well, how long do you have to do it for? And it's interesting because we don't really ask that for, you know, psoriasis or atopic dermatitis. Like, of course you have to continue, you know, kind of indefinitely, right? But there's this interesting thing about alopecia areata where people want to know what happens when you stop. And the majority of patients, if you stop, they will lose hair. So I think, you know, for most people, this is something that they are going to be taking for the long haul. And, you know, they just need to also, you know, understand that from the outset. But I would say most patients also, I think, are, you know, are kind of aware of that. They ask the question, but I think that they understand that this is, you know, a treatment and not a cure.
Yeah. And also the, in terms of taking it long-term, they often ask like, oh, you know, what about the long-term risks? And they're quite open, you know, they're quite understanding that there's a lot we still don't know about the long-term risk in terms of malignancy and cardiovascular risks. Like they know that these are things that we still don't have the answers for. And often they are quite willing to try and see how it goes. And like you said, we're lucky that they're young. Usually they're very young and fit and well patients.
Yeah, it makes our job a lot easier when they are, I think. Yeah. And I think, you know, on the long-term risks are for sure, you know, the biggest unknowns. I think on a daily basis, though, most people are happy to learn that these drugs are largely very well tolerated. I mean, it's pretty uncommon to have, you know, adverse effects. We see weight gain. Sometimes we see acne. Some people are calling it jackney, you know, not infrequently, especially in younger populations. Laboratory abnormalities, really quite uncommon. The most common thing we see is elevations in lipids, you know, cholesterol in particular. But all of that is part of the conversation.
Yeah, and absolutely. And that's something that, because if some of them have been through treatments like azathioprine or methotrexate, where they felt really rough with those, or they've had DPC, which is where they get the contact immunotherapy, and they get the sort of the eczema being developed on the scalp to help the hair grow. Those are uncomfortable treatments, and they are sometimes not very well tolerated. So in comparison with JAK inhibitors, some of them feel like there's, you know, they're not even taking a treatment. They're like, I take a pill every day and it's, you know, it's fine. I don't feel sick. You know, some of the acne actually gets better after a while. It's not too difficult to manage. And some of them don't mind having the acne if it means their hair is growing. But yeah, in terms of the cholesterol and the triglycerides, it definitely is something that needs sort of keeping an eye on, because those, even in the young ones, it tends to go up.
Yeah, that is, I would say that's the one parameter that we see, you know, change not infrequently. And when somebody's going to be on one of these medications chronically, I think it does sort of behoove us to think about, you know, being more aggressive with lipid management. I think as a community, that's something we need to sort of sit down and figure out, you know, who do we treat and when do we treat them? Because as people are on these medicines longer and longer, that question is coming up. And so we're also learning, you know, so if you look at the clinical trial data, I would say about on average by, you know, 40 to 52 weeks, about 40% of patients in general are sort of quote responders. So in the clinical trials, all the patients to date anyways have had to have at least 50% hair loss. And the primary endpoint is looking at the percent of people who get to 20% or less hair loss. Now, most of the patients in these trials had, you know, almost no hair, you know, the average SALT scores, or which are, you know, just sort of a measure of how much hair loss is involved, are very high in these patients. But I think what's interesting is that in clinical practice, I find that these medicines do a little bit better than that. And I think that's often because we are able, you know, real life is not a clinical trial, right? We're able to add things, especially oral minoxidil. And I know you've used a lot of oral minoxidil. So maybe do you want to just share with everybody, you know, adding it to JAX and how that can have sort of a synergistic effect?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you that I think, you know, in clinical practice, I think the success rate is higher than what we've seen with the trials, because you can, you know, you can optimize things, give them, you know, if they just have small areas that are still persisting, you can give them the steroid injections and you can give them the oral minoxidil, which they can take alongside the JAK inhibitor. That's also very well tolerated. And I think sometimes it helps just, I think, push through those vellus hairs into becoming terminal hairs and getting that density that they're needing. It also helps, you know, in eczema, for example, we start with lower doses of the JAK inhibitors and go up if we need to. But I think with alopecia areata, I think we have to probably start high and go low once they've starting to regrow and maintain. I don't know what, if you, there's no standard approach yet. I think that's something we still need to figure out. But I think definitely from the trials and from practice, the higher doses tend to do better.
Yeah, we're definitely learning more about, you know, factors that can influence response to treatment. And, you know, not to obviously dose, as you mentioned, is that's kind of a no brainer. But we're also learning about things like severity of scalp hair. So from the baricitinib clinical trials, they've showed that patients with 50 to 94% hair loss do quite a bit better than those with 95 to 100 sort of, so severe versus very severe hair loss. And then we're also learning that how long you haven't had hair or you've had very severe alopecia areata also impacts response. So we talk about this number, sort of the duration of your current episode of alopecia areata, which is an important number. And that kind of refer it for people with severe disease, how long has it been that severe? Not how long has it been since you got your first patch, but if you have no hair, how long has it been since, you know, you lost everything? And that number, I think we, you know, an early data suggested maybe 7 to 10 years of, you know, severe disease, your chance of responding started to decrease, but now we're learning that number is probably lower, maybe around 4 years. So this is another reason to kind of think about treating earlier. It's not to say that people with that, with very, you know, very long duration of hair loss can't respond. It's just that their chance really starts to decrease. And we do know that, you know, on scalp biopsies in some patients, you see fibrosis over time, right? So we think of this, we think alopecia areata is a non-scarring hair loss. You can always get your hair back, but that's actually not necessarily true. So patients who've had, you know, no hair for 15 or 20 years, you know, it's not a reason not to try. But they are, you know, have a much lower chance of responding compared to somebody who comes in and has had maybe 2 years of severe disease. So that's an important thing to talk, I think, talk about in the clinic and sort of help prognosticate for patients.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is different to the other inflammatory conditions we've treated because, you know, time is of essence in alopecia areata. So you don't want to sort of watch and wait, which is used to be our approach. It used to be very much like watch and wait and see if, you know, spontaneous regrowth, but the severe ones are unlikely to spontaneously regrow. And the trials have helped us understand that better as well. And that's why also being able to address their expectations. Certainly there have been people with longer than 10 years of alopecia totalis that have regrown with these treatments. But it is important to sort of address their expectation to not, you know, to not let them down if it doesn't regrow. I think it helps. It helps with the whole consultation and their own sort of hope and, you know, the whole hope and loss cycle that happens, the emotional roller coaster that they feel when they go on JAK inhibitors and they don't regrow.
Yeah, that can be really hard. And I think, you know, something that we have to talk about in the beginning. And I think there are people who, you know, you may end up having a conversation if somebody comes in and they've had no hair for, you know, 20 years, they may, you know, many of them will want to try, I think, but I think for some people, it's almost like kind of reopening an old wound and the idea of kind of getting their hopes up to potentially, or, you know, decent chance to be let down may actually be harder. So this is, again, where that kind of shared decision making comes in. And you know, another thing that I think that's interesting that we're starting to see now is that, you know, now that we have baricitinib and soon we'll be able to use ritlecitinib, we're able to try different JAK inhibitors in different, you know, in the same patient, right? So now I would have thought that failure of one means failure of all, but it actually is turning out not to be the case. And so I think that's a really interesting thing that we'll learn. And maybe, you know, fast forward 5 or 10 years, we'll be able to say, oh, you have these characteristics, you know, this medicine makes more sense for you. So, you know, there's a lot of cool things that I think getting to use the medicines in practice, we're going to be able to see. And I have a handful of patients now who didn't grow on tofacitinib, which I sort of think of as a very effective medicine because it is sort of more broadly acting, who are growing hair on baricitinib. Now I have some patients who I switched from tofacitinib to baricitinib who are you know, have gotten patches back. So I think, you know, we're still kind of at the beginning of all this in terms of learning, you know, all the nuance.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a very important point, because I also assumed, you know, if you fail one, then you fail all, because it's a jack stat and, you know, it's the same kind of pathway. But you're right. It's actually really fascinating when you see that switches and you see that they regrow. Some of them, you know, had partial regrowth with tofacitinib or no regrowth. And then suddenly with baricitinib, they seem to do really well. So it will be very interesting in a few years time when we have the extended trial data as well as like clinical practice data to see how things plan out and to be able to phenotype these patients to better decide on treatments, which is what we're doing with psoriasis now. You know, we are sort of choosing, we can pick and choose what's the right treatment for the right patient.
Yeah, I think it's just only getting better for patients. You know, there's like so much reason to be hopeful. And I think we may not have to go through the sort of trial and error that we sometimes do now. Before we wrap up, I think should spend just a little bit of time talking about, you know, dose reduction. We mentioned that most patients need to, you know, continue treatment indefinitely. Baricitinib in the United States has a label. There are two doses, so 4 milligrams and 2 milligrams. The 4 milligram dose per the label is meant to be used for people with, you know, very severe hair loss. But there is a comment that once somebody has had an adequate response, to decrease the dose to 2 milligrams. Now, I think in clinical practice, that is not probably the best idea. And in fact, if you look at their data a year later, you know, only if people going from 4 milligrams to 2 milligrams, only about half of them are maintaining their response. So I think this is something that's really important and different for hair. You know, if someone has atopic dermatitis or psoriasis and we dose reduce or maybe space out the interval of their biologic or something and they flare, well, we can kind of get back fairly quickly to where we were. But if you have a patient who's been, you know, especially people who wear their hair longer, who's been growing their hair for, you know, 2, 3+ years, and you just cut the dose in half and they start to lose hair, well, all of a sudden you're going back in time, you know, a long time, right? I think it's just important to remember that the stakes are very high with hair. And so kind of abrupt changes are really probably not a good idea for most patients.
Yeah. And yeah, you kind of lost the work that you've done for a year, you know, for a year, and then they have to go back to regrowing. And especially if it's in a visible area, it can be quite distressing for them. So yeah, so I guess we don't know yet when the best time to start reducing, but I certainly am now waiting for at least 6 to 12 months of no relapses at all before even considering it.
Yeah. And I think for me, you know, somebody has to have even to consider going down at all, someone has to have complete regrowth. They have to make it through, yeah, several months or a year or more. And then if I do decrease, I tend to do it very, very slowly. I might have them take half dose 3 days a week and then the regular dose the other 4 days. And we do that for 6 months or something. So it's sort of like the slowest taper you've ever done in your life. And then there are some patients who are able, you know, to decrease. And I do anecdotally have a handful of patients who have actually come off. But I think what's hard is we don't really know who those people are going to be. And of course, because alopecia areata by nature waxes and wanes, you know, someone might be doing well at this point in time, but a year from now, it could be a totally different story. So I think, you know, any dose reduction should be done with the utmost caution and just kind of remembering that this is a different disease from other things that we're used to treating and that the stakes are very high.
Yeah. And actually the relapses, if they get small relapses, you can contain them with the steroid injections or other treatments. So, you know, you manage to take them off completely from the JAK inhibitors, but they may need small treatments here and there, which is quite reassuring. I think also what's reassuring is when they relapse and you go back up the dose, they seem to respond quite quickly again. So they don't lose efficacy. Well, at least from my experience in clinical practice, they don't seem to lose the efficacy to the drug, which is good.
Yeah. And we're gonna get to see more and more kind of systematic data thanks to the active clinical trial. Well, this has been great. I encourage all those listening to think about reaching for a JAK inhibitor in your patients with severe alopecia areata. They really are a targeted therapy. We're fortunate in some areas to have some that are on label now. And yes, it is a little bit more of a conversation in terms of there are different things to think about with different patients. There is a box warning that we need to discuss, but it is so much fun to see these patients come back. It is the most rewarding experience, I think, as a physician. So you will be paid back greatly in terms of their relationships with your patients and feeling like you really, you made a meaningful difference in their life, which is why we all went into this in the first place. So, thank you so much, Dr. Aspor, for joining us.
And thank you for having me.
Thank you to all of you who are listening. Please remember, if you want to learn more about alopecia areata, you can go to the AA Learning Zone on MedThority. And we really appreciate you listening to this podcast series about alopecia areata.